You know, if a company didn't fully endorse its own products, you'd be right to lack confidence in that product. So what are Christians saying about the Bible when they don't stand behind the very first chapter? We'll examine the question next on Grace to You. Who doesn't use a computer or a DVD player these days, some piece of equipment that you don't totally understand 100%? In other words, just because you don't know what every button does or how it works and can't explain the engineering behind the device, that hasn't kept you from using it, has it? So for the Christian, why not accept the issues of sin, salvation, heaven, and hell, big issues like that, and yet leave the issue of origins to someone else? Just sort of put the creation versus evolution question out of mind. John MacArthur's series, currently on Grace to You, is helping you answer that question. The study is from Genesis chapter 1, and it's all about the battle for the beginning. And here with today's lesson is John MacArthur.
December 1996 brought the death of an evolutionist and astronomer by the name of Carl Sagan, probably the most well-known astronomer in the world. His perception was that life just sort of happened. And he ended up his life with absolute emptiness, absolute hopelessness. And near the end of his life, he was interviewed by Ted Koppel on television. Koppel asked Sagan, realizing he was at the end of his life, that he had spent his life in science studying the universe as an astronomer. He said, "Do you, sir, have any words of wisdom for the people of the world?" To which Sagan replied, and I quote, "We live on a hunk of rock and metal that circles a humdrum star that is one of 400 plus billion other stars that make up the Milky Way galaxy, which is one of billions of other galaxies which make up a universe which may be one of a large number, perhaps an infinite number of other universes. That is well worth pondering." End quote. He thought about it, and he thought about it, and he thought about it, and he never let God be a reality. In the end, the most brilliant evolutionist only knows that the universe exists. He doesn't know how. He doesn't know why. And mostly he doesn't know who the Creator is. How sad. Everything in the universe points to God, the Creator. Even Albert Einstein said, "Of course there is a massive intelligence behind the universe. A man is a fool who doesn't believe that." And then went on to say, "But we could never know him." The humanistic evolutionist refuses to see what is obvious, refuses to meet the God who wants to be known. Back to the created order itself, again, the complexity and diversity leave you with no other possible explanation than divine intelligence and divine power of proportions beyond our comprehension. I just pick out little pieces of the created order that speak to this complexity and diversity and share a few of them with you. Some birds navigate by the stars when migrating. How do they know how to do that? In fact, birds raised from eggs inside a building where they have never seen the sky can orient themselves toward home when shown an artificial sky representing a place they've never been. Moths have two ears. Mites, little microscopic bugs, like to live in a moth's ear. But interestingly enough, mites occupy only one ear of a moth. If mites get in both ears, the moth can't fly. So scientists find mites only in one ear. How do the mites know that one ear is occupied? And then the fascinating bombardier beetle has two chemicals in his little body which mix perfectly and at the right moment combine outside his body. When they're fired and they intersect, they explode in the face of the enemy. That's why they're called bombardier beetles. However, the two chemicals that create an explosion outside the body never combine prematurely to blow up the beetle. And by the way, how did the beetle evolve those explosives and keep them separate? The University of Alberta, Canada, once showed that in that temperate climate, there are an average of 1,800 storms in operation at any time. And that those 1,800 storms in operation at any time expend energy at the inconceivable figure of 1,300,000,000 horsepower. Where does that come from? A Canadian physicist said a rain of 4 inches over an area of 10,000 square miles would require the burning of 640 million tons of coal to evaporate enough water for such a rain. And to cool again the vapors and collect them in clouds would take another 800 million horsepower of refrigeration working 24 hours a day for 100 days. And yet God, by the massive power of the sun, evaporates the water, refrigerates it in the sky, sends it back down again as water. By the way, the average farmer in Minnesota is provided free of charge 407,510 gallons of water per acre per year. By that process, if the annual rainfall of 24 inches is occurring. Now, where does all this power come from? The U.S. Natural Museum says there are over 10 million different species of insects. There are 2,500 kinds of ants. I know, they were all at your last picnic. One colony of ants can have as many as 100 million ants. How do those little tiny things have such a reproductive system? Some have estimated there are 5 billion birds in America. Mallards can fly 60 miles an hour, eagles can fly 100 miles an hour, and falcons can dive at 180 miles an hour. By the way, codfish, not that you need to know, can lay 9 million eggs, and herring only 70,000. I don't have any other comment. Just that is enough to stagger me. 9 million eggs? 9 million little codfish? That's why there's so many fish and chips places in England. You never run out of that stuff. The Earth is 25,000 miles in circumference, weighs 6 septillion, 586 sextillion tons, hangs in empty space, spins at 1,000 miles an hour with perfect balance, and that's important so that you're not just jumping every time the Earth moves. At the same time that it's spinning at 1,000 miles an hour, it is moving through space around the sun at 1,000 miles a minute in an orbit of 580 million miles. And does so at a perfect angle set to create the seasons which provide all the crops which feed its inhabitants. Comet heads can be from 10,000 miles to 1 million miles long, and the tails can be 100 million miles long. They travel at 350 miles per second. Your heart, about the size of your fist, weighs less than half a pound, pumps 1,800 plus gallons of blood a day, does enough work in 12 hours to lift 65 tons off the ground. Did you know that the sun burns up, this is staggering, 4 million tons of matter per second? Consider things that are very small, like the atom. They're not visible. We know they exist, but to this day, they're not visible. Atoms are so small, it takes 3 atoms to make up 1 water molecule. And if you were to take every water molecule in one drop of water and blow them up so that each molecule was the size of a grain of sand, now this is one water molecule. If you were to take every molecule in one drop of water and blow it up the size of a grain of sand, you would have enough grains of sand to make a road 1 foot thick, 1/2 mile wide that would go from L.A. to New York City. That's how many molecules in a drop of water. And there's three atoms in every molecule. And yet the atom is mostly empty space. The actual material in the atom takes up only 1/1,000,000,000th of the atom's volume. And when atoms combine, they only join together at their outer electron orbit, that's all. What makes matter seem solid are the motions within the atoms. Everything is mostly empty space. If the average person had all the space squeezed out of him. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? If the average person had all the space squeezed out of him, how much volume do you think he'd occupy? If you had all the space squeezed out of you, you'd be lost on the head of a pin. For you could only occupy 1/100,000,000th of a cubic inch. So when somebody comes along and says, you're nothing, they're right. But on the other side, you're thinking diet, I know. You're thinking there's got to be a way to make this work. But I want you to know, a full cubic inch of that material would weigh 1,000,000,000 pounds. A teaspoonful of water contains 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, all happened by accident? Come on. Let me talk about the wheel of life. This fascinates me. I mentioned who invented the wheel, and somebody said the Mayans did. No, the Mayans didn't. God did. There's a wheel of life. You've got them all through you. The wheel that I'm talking about, the wheel of life, scientists call it the wheel of life, is found in the enzyme ATP synthase. Its structure has only recently been elucidated and has won a joint Nobel Prize in 1997 for two scientists, Paul Boyer of the USA and John Walker of the UK. The wheel in this enzyme rotates at about 100 revolutions per second. This miniature motor is 200,000 times smaller than a pinhead. And it's revolving 100 revolutions per second. Every cell in your body and every cell in every living thing has thousands of these motors. Every cell in every living thing has thousands of these motors in just one cell. Someone estimated that your body has 10 quadrillion little motors. Now, let me tell you what the little motor does. The ATP motor's job is to make the molecule adenosine triphosphate, ATP, from adenosine diphosphate, ADP, and phosphoric acid, a synthesis which requires an input of energy. The ATP can then break down to ADP again, giving up the energy by coupling itself to another chemical process within the cell which requires the energy in order to react. So energy is directed and the products are recycled constantly, constantly in that little tiny motor of which you have 10 quadrillion going on all the time. Says Dr. Walker, we require our body weight in ATP every day. So the little motors has to reproduce your entire body weight every day. We're turning over that amount of ATP, cycling that energy to keep ourselves thinking and walking around doing whatever we do. If we have a lazy day, we will only use about half our body weight of ATP. But if we work hard, up to 1 ton of ATP is recycled in a day. In 1993, Professor Boyer deduced by indirect means how ATP was produced, but it was left to Dr. Walker in 1994 to provide the first detailed picture of how the motor works. He used X-rays and an electron microscope to take an atomic snapshot. And then some Japanese fellow came along in 1997 with a tiny fluorescent filament attached to the electron microscope so that the motor could be seen spinning under the microscope. These extremely complex little spinning motors are brilliantly designed. Each motor is built from 31 separate proteins. Now remember, this is 200,000 times smaller than the head of a pin. And they have 31 protein components that are made from thousands of precisely arranged amino acids. Am I losing you? It gets worse. This thing goes on paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. These little machines are producing with every turn of the wheel at some 100 revolutions per second. They are producing the necessary energy cycle to keep you alive and keep you functioning. It's incredible, says Dr. Walker, to think of these motors of life spinning around in all the cells of our bodies. And they're spinning in all the cells of everything that lives. Who designed these little wheel motors? Who energized them? Psalm 139:14 says, "We were fearfully and wonderfully made." Now, my friend R.C. Sproul is part theologian and part philosopher. And I appreciate him for his theology, but I really appreciate him for his philosophy. He is actually a funny philosopher because he can make people look so foolish that you can hardly help but chuckle. Now, Sproul says there are only four options for the origin of the universe. You only have four. Option number one, the universe is an illusion. It doesn't exist. That's option number one. Option number two, it is self-created. Option number three, it is self-existent and eternal. Option number four, it was created by someone who is self-existent. Sproul says there aren't any other options. Either it doesn't exist, or it created itself, or it always existed, or somebody created it. That's it. He says, "I have puzzled over this for decades and sought the counsel of philosophers, theologians, and scientists. I have been unable to locate any other theoretical options that cannot be subsumed under these four options." That's all you've got. Then Sproul says, option number one must be eliminated for two reasons. That's the option that says it doesn't exist. It's all an illusion. First, if it's a false illusion, then it isn't an illusion. If it's a true illusion, then someone or something must be existing to have that illusion. If this is the case, then that which is having the illusion must either be self-created, self-existent, or caused by someone ultimately self-existent. So therefore, everything is not an illusion. Secondly, he says, you can eliminate number one, the illusion theory, because if we assume the illusion is absolute, that is, nothing does exist, including that which is having the illusion, then there is no question of origins even to answer, because literally nothing exists. But if something exists, then whatever exists must either be self-created, self-existent, or created by someone who is self-existent. Let's look at option two, that the universe created itself. Well, this is by all logic formally false. It is contradictory and logically impossible. Sproul says, in essence, self-creation requires the existence of something before it exists. You get that? You can't create yourself unless you exist to create yourself. Self-creation is a logical and rational impossibility, he writes. For something to create itself, it must be before it is. This is impossible. It's impossible for solids, liquids, and gases. It's impossible for atoms and subatomic particles. It is impossible for light. It is impossible for heat. It is impossible for God. Nothing, anywhere, anytime can create itself, because if it could, it would have to exist before it created itself. Sproul points out that an entity can be self-existent and not violate logic, but it can't be self-created. When scientists say that, well, 15 to 20 billion years ago, the universe created itself. What are they saying? They're saying nothing exploded into something. That is a logical impossibility. To retain a theory of self-creation is totally irrational and rejects all logic. Such a theory can be believed, but it can't be argued reasonably. And you've got option number three, that the universe, as it exists, as we know it, has always existed eternally. Well, that doesn't fly. You're not eternal, and neither am I. We didn't always exist. There was a time when we didn't exist. There was a time when our children didn't exist. There are all kinds of things in this world that once did not exist. In fact, everything around us once did not exist. How could the universe exist forever and then do in time, i.e. create life, what it had never done forever? If the universe always existed, then everything in it always existed. And we know everything in it didn't always exist because you and I didn't always exist. Our parents will verify that. You cannot be born and be always existing. Cars and watches and chairs and all that were brought into existence at some point in time. Option one, option two, option three are impossible. We're left with only one possibility. The universe exists because it was created by someone who existed before it existed. A pre-existing, intelligent power, namely God. Matter can't create itself. Only an eternal, pre-existing God could create. CNN reported that only 9% of Americans believe that life arose purely by chance. That's good, isn't it? But the vast majority, you can flip the figures over, over 90% of the people in America believe that God was involved in creation, but that God used evolution as his method. And we've been trying to point out to you that that can't be how God created, because evolution is what? Impossible. Absolutely impossible. That's why there's no evidence for it, because it can't happen. The sin of evolutionists is described in Romans 1. The wrath of God, verse 18, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. The truth of a creator God is obvious. It's absolutely obvious, reasonable, logical, but they suppress the truth. Verse 19, that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them by reason, by logic, by cause and effect. It is apparent. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. You cannot conclude anything other than that there was an eternal pre-existing creator. That is the only reasonable conclusion. And consequently, those who reject that and suppress that truth, Romans 1:20 says, are without excuse. Even though they knew God. I mean, there's no other possible reasonable conclusion. They refused to honor him as God, refused to thank him, became empty in their speculations. Their foolish heart is darkened. They think they're wise. They have all their PhDs and all of that, but they are actually fools. They exchange the glory of the incorruptible God into the image of a corruptible man, birds, four-footed animals, crawling creatures. They worship the creature more than the creator. They make the creature the creator. Life creates itself. Romans 1. They worship the creation. They see the creation as the life force which creates. Logically ridiculous.
The battle for the beginning. That's John's current study here on Grace to You. It's a look at the fierce creation-evolution conflict, a battle that's waging even in churches today. John, you quoted Einstein. Basically, I think it said, you're a fool if you don't believe that a massive intelligence created the universe, but sadly, man can't know that created being. Well, you'd say, I know just the opposite is true. Not only can the creator of the universe be known, he wants us to know him.
Yes, he can be known, and that is the stunning reality. Einstein did say that God has to be there, something that he called God, but he could never be known. And the reason Einstein said that is very simple. Einstein died a totally unfulfilled and unhappy man because he couldn't define the power that bound the components of the universe together. You know, he was studying things like the quantum leap. Something goes out of existence inside an atom over here, comes into existence inside an atom over there and never traverses the space in between. It's called quantum theory or quantum leap. What's the power that moves it instantaneously? He never could find that. He defined that as God, but said since he couldn't know it, as smart as he was, nobody could know it. One thing he failed to recognize was that no scientist is going to find God by looking into the quantum leap. You're going to find God by looking into the scripture. Oh, certainly God has revealed his power and his deity in creation, but not his person. His person can only be known savingly, forgivingly, graciously through scripture. Sooner or later, we have to turn to the special revelation of the Word of God. That's why we're here. And that's why we're telling you about how you can know God. Let me tell you about a free message, The Certainty of God's Existence. We'll send it to you if you just ask.
John prepared this message to challenge unbelievers with questions like, why are you here? How do you find meaning in life? And what happens when you die? It'll help you defend what you believe or help clear up questions maybe that you've had yourself. The Certainty of God's Existence. Again, request your free copy, The Certainty of God's Existence. Please contact us today. Our mailing address is Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California 91412. Or send an email to request it. That address is letters@gty.org. Remember, you can also fax a request to this number, area code 661-295-5871. Again, 661-295-5871. Or call toll-free requesting a copy of The Certainty of God's Existence, your choice on CD or cassette. The number is 1-800-55-GRACE. Numerically, that translates to 1-800-554-7223. Now, if you send a letter or a fax or an email, be sure that you include your mailing address and mention the call letters of this radio station. The address here, again, is Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. The email address is letters@gty.org. Or call toll-free 1-800-55-GRACE. However you contact us, let us know that you're learning from God's Word, perhaps from this current study, The Battle for the Beginning, or just one of the recent titles, maybe the Salvation Survey. Thanks, too, for praying for John MacArthur and the entire staff. It's a great way to minister to us. We do need your prayers. And now for John and the staff, I'm Carl Miller, thanking you for setting aside this part of your day to join us. You'll want to do that tomorrow, we hope, as John continues unleashing creation truth, one verse at a time, on the next Grace to You. What do you say to a friend, a teacher, the person in your life who says there is no God? Learn how to put up a strong biblical defense. That's coming tomorrow on the next Grace to You.